In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums.
C-R-I-M-E-W-A-V. Yeah, yeah. You're rolling with the Crime Wave, the internet's first and only podcast devoted to the crime short story. I'm Seth Harwood, your host, the first name in crime podcast fiction, and I'm ready to bring you this week's story. The Crime Wave is produced by Mystery Dog, Aldo Calcagno, and it is not safe for your minivans. That means it might contain swearing, violence, and all types of shit.
Consider yourselves warned.
This is Craig Clevenger. The story I'm reading is called The Numbers Game, from the forthcoming San Francisco Noir 2 anthology, edited by Peter Marvellis. Jimmy Rehab's showing a 9-up against my dual 8s. Now the high count is my green light to buck tourist strategy, so I split for a hard 18-15, then stand. Jimmy's ace in the hole gives him a soft 20, which costs me another 6,000 milligrams of tetracycline. 15 blocks from here, young mothers push strollers through Golden Gate Park and the electro poets sip $6 coffees at sidewalk tables along Irving. Keep walking west and the bright afternoon grows indecisive at 19th Avenue until you hit 25th and you take off your shades, but you can't tell the difference. The light bright enough to see by without throwing any shadows. And come 43rd, you haven't seen another soul for 10 blocks, and the stores are either empty or closed, and the colors vanish along with the shadows. The current drains from the sunlight. This is San Francisco's outer sunset. Another ghost town trailing another gold rush. The post-war housing boom following the first feeding frenzy a century prior and the dot-com locusts that came 40 years later. This is where Jimmy and I play blackjack by the light of a camping lantern. Where I'll play 2.5 million hands before I see sunlight again. I'm here because of the numbers. Because this is the one place some very bad people won't know to find me. I'm here because I made a wager and I made good on my bets. I'm here because I keep my word. Skinner Jones said that would be the death of me, and he was half right. Skinner Jones and I did a jewelry store together a couple of years back. No fireworks, all business. After the dust had settled, the adjusters left the owner with a firm handshake and a fat check. Skinner moved the product, cleaned the cash, and handed over my cut. Next day, I'm using the restroom at that donut place on Polk. One second, I'm holding 2 bear claws and a paper bag between my teeth while I take a leak. Next thing, I've got smoke and mirrors on either side of me. Johnny Farrow. Yo, Johnny. I was shaking off the drops when smoke slapped the bracelet onto my right wrist and gave me to the count of 1 to pack myself up before he cuffed my left. Then he pat me down way too familiar-like while mirrors read from his Miranda card. His fingers followed the words as he sounded them out, like he was asking directions with a phrase book. I was drooling on the donut bag in my teeth when Mirrors said, "Do you understand the rights as they've been read to you?" Yeah, I understood. Out loud, shithead and smoke tapped the back of my skull, so I dropped my breakfast into that hot pool at my feet. An old greasy bag floating with the cigarette butts and that blue chemical puck. "I'm not sure I did," I said. "Could you run them by me one more time?" Smoke and mirrors. Bad cop. Worse cop. 11 hours under the light, cuffed to a chair on the business end of their bad day. I asked if the batteries were fresh because I thought the red light on the camera blinked a couple of times. "Not sure. Why do you ask?" See, if that camera went dark, I was going to hit the floor, hard, 2 or 3 times. All I had to say were 2 words, Skinner Jones, and I'd walk. But I didn't. Taking a job means keeping your mouth shut. And getting stabbed in the back isn't licensed to likewise shank a brother. Keeping my word meant keeping quiet, which meant I did a year inside. The most they could give me without Skinner Jones. Jimmy can't shuffle, so I do it for him. You gonna make me deal for you this time too, Jimmy? He doesn't answer me. Jimmy rehabs silent treatment, day 55. You lazy fuck, I tell him. His stare is starting to unnerve me. Jimmy's got a 4-up, and I'm looking at a hard 16, so I stand. His whole card is a 10, followed by another 4, so I push 2,500 more milligrams of tetracycline his way and pray I don't get sick before I can win him back. I bust 3 more hands in a row, and Jimmy doesn't say a word. His expression doesn't change. I've lost thousands in a single sitting at some big tables, and I've always had enough to cover my marker. Well, most of the time. I can quit any time I want as long as it's not while I'm playing. And if you're anything like me, you tell yourself you've got it under control. But you don't. So I did a year. 12 months later, I walked through the gates, but my celebration was cut short that same afternoon. Dear cardholder didn't place an undisclosed sum came strong out of the gate but finished dead last. Some old habits die hard. Others not at all. So that afternoon at the track dumped me $20,000 into Hoyle's pocket. Now, Hoyle knew I was good for it because I keep my word. But Hoyle didn't want to look weak. Skinner Jones and his brokering skills were the only things keeping me above the dirt. His driver had been kicked back on a parole violation, so Skinner Jones offered me a job again. Guy blows an early release because he bought his piss from Keith Richards, he said. He's safer in Folsom. Yeah, I hear that. Then neither one of us said anything for a moment. Wasn't me, Skinner said, and he slid the car keys towards me. Wasn't you what? The jewelry store, he said. It wasn't me who gave you up. And there was my chance, served up like a fancy umbrella drink. Call him on it or let it go. Forget about it, I said. Skinner let it go faster than I had. Went right back to talking the job. Far as this job goes, he said, you wait and you drive. Shit hits the fan, plan Q is still locked and loaded. We're in, we're out, we hurt nobody, and you're off the hook. Yeah, and I won't see a penny of it, I said. But I wouldn't have pennies over my eyes either. Yeah. His ex-driver's fuck-up and my own were conjoined like circus sideshow babies. Two in the same. A good plan leaves nothing to chance, but a pro knows that chance is a long-haul player. You drink enough, gamble enough, sleep around, skydive, hitchhike, or play the lottery, and your luck won't run out, but it will change. Skinner Jones and I had been at it for a long time, and our luck changed. Come 10:21 a.m. the next day, I was gunning through red lights down O'Farrell with my back windshield in pieces, my ears ringing, and Jimmy Rehab riding shotgun with glass in his hair and blood on his pants. I turned up the police scanner and kept the speed limit once I was off Lincoln. And the cityscape levels out about the same time I stopped seeing people around 14th and Judah. Clapboard craftsman shacks swap rot with crumbling Victorian sandblasted by ocean wind and salt, their bright candy colors dulled to the shade of the surrounding fog. Judah's dead end disappears along with the horizon, a blur of neither ocean nor sky, and even on a clear day it's like looking at a faded photograph. Plateau of muted roof lines tethered by utility cables at the edge of the world. Plan Q. 2-bedroom Spanish bungalow on the outside, pure Boy Scout bomb shelter on the inside. Chemical toilet for a bathroom. floor-to-ceiling warehouse shelving throughout the master bedroom and living room. Bottled water, canned food, foil pouches of freeze-dried field rations with Russian and German labels. 2-foot lockers marked with red crosses. A portable television and a propane-run generator with an exhaust hose that disappeared through a hole in the back door. A briefcase of clay chips with 4 new card decks and enough liquor to drown the cabin fever. Skinner had shut off the utilities, boarded up the windows, and in every respect, ensured that a man could wait a long time inside this place. The punchline? Kitchen cabinets, labeled Ralph and George, every inch packed with tins of smoked oysters, sardines, albacore tuna, Alaskan salmon. See, Skinner had a big soft spot for his cats, but they gave me the creeps. The half-Siamese named George had eyes the color of a gas flame, and this unwavering, blinkless blue stare, like he could bend metal with his mind. I swear my watch stopped if I pet him too long, and I think he tripped my car alarm a couple times, knocked out the streetlights when he saw me coming. The other one, Ralph, just a leaden stump of orange fur. I never saw Ralph move from his spot on Skinner's balcony, not once. But I never saw the same pile of feathers beside him either. Skinner Jones, secretly sentimental bastard, had planned on spoiling his cats rotten when the apocalypse came while he lived on protein bars and dried noodles. Jimmy slumped into a folding chair. "I'm hit," he said. His right leg had gone dark and a wet flap of his jeans hung from his bloody thigh. "You drip anything outside?" "Fuck you, Pharaoh. I'm going to bleed to death if you don't get me to a hospital." "You'll bleed to death if you don't relax," I said, and I rummaged through the medical trunks. I found some rubbing alcohol, bandages, and everything, pretty much, from first aid to field surgery gear, along with some bootleg pharmaceuticals. "Get your jeans off, Jimmy, so I can take a look." "I am not letting your wannabe doctor ass play operation on me," Jimmy said, and he stood, favoring his good leg. "Where are the car keys?" "By the door," I said. When the dumb shit turned to look, I yanked the cat from the bottle of rubbing alcohol and splashed his wound. "But good," Jimmy said, "mother," and clenched his teeth and dropped back into his chair. "Now, if you were hurt serious, Jimmy, you'd have bled all over my car." "It is serious. Fucker shot me." "Maybe. Looks like a movie bullet to me." Starting with the rip in his thigh, I sliced his jeans open while he called me a choice name or two. "Best you not struggle while my knife's this close to your nutsack," I said. "So what the fuck's a movie bullet, Johnny?" "A movie bullet, Jimmy, is one of those statistically mythical rounds, the kind that only hit your shoulder or leg." I doused the wound with more alcohol and Jimmy twitched, then clamped himself still. "They never hit an artery and they never mushroom or fragment. You know, the kind of shit that only happens to heroes in movies while people in real life drop dead. Or," Jimmy says, "a guy drops dead because the quack sewing him up decides to make a clever speech while his fucking blood pours down the drain." I didn't see anything but a few slices in his skin and a wedge of glass that dropped out of his jeans. Still, I decided against going gently with him. Poked at his leg with a pair of needle-nose pliers while I looked for errant shards. "The guy fired at us from behind, genius. You cut yourself on some glass. Any ideas?" "It's probably your windshield," Jimmy said. "This is from a mirror. You hit something when they chased you out of there." "I don't remember," Jimmy said. "That sawed-off came out and I just ran. Crashed through all kinds of shit." I cleaned him up, sealed the cuts with crazy glue, then wrapped his leg. Jimmy asked for a hospital again, and I said no again, that we'd stay out of sight and wait for Skinner. I listened to the police frequencies. Nobody in custody, my car last seen on Van Ness. "Skinner take anything with him when he split?" I asked him. "Big-ass gym bag," Jimmy said. "Fucker was full, too, way overdue for a pickup." That's a lot of hand jobs. And then some, Jimmy said. The place is a collection point. The score that morning was a massage parlor in the Tenderloin. Normally not the most lucrative hit, but I trusted Skinner had his reasons and I was right. So, they count it and bag it before they kick it up the ladder, I said. That's got to be cash from a half dozen hand towel lube shops. At least, after they cut a slice for the cops, the bagman disappear the rest. I don't suppose, Jimmy, you know which cops they cut a slice for. I tore off a strip of surgical tape with my teeth to seal the bandages. Same ones we all are, Jimmy said. And my insides turned to lead. Skinner Jones had pulled a 180 on his own plan midway through a job. The job itself, both a good score and a calculated burn, aimed at the city's two most rancid cops and their double-barreled hard-on for yours truly. Skinner didn't fill you in, Jimmy said. He told me nothing. Let me guess, no fireworks, all business. Yeah, something like that. You being in the dark with Skinner? I don't like it. Well, I like it even less, Jimmy. So how come you know about this place? Jimmy opened a can of warm PBR. The 4x4 stack of cases between the chairs could double as a card table. It belongs to Skinner, I told him. He took a long pull from his beer, kept his glare fixed on me. Chill, rehab. Anyone tries following the paper trail, they'll starve to death before Skinner's name turns up. I resumed tossing through the medical supplies. Skinner called this his Plan Q, I said. This was his last resort if anything ever went thermonuclear shit fan wrong. He could wait out the heat right under their noses. First time I've actually been here, to tell you the truth. Wasn't sure I'd memorized the right street number until I walked inside. So who else knows about it, Johnny? Nobody. You positive? Of course. How's that? I gave Skinner my word, Jimmy. You ought to know me by now. I need a shower. Jimmy crushed the can and reached for another. Wouldn't mind uncovering one of the windows. This place feels cramped. Nobody knows this place is occupied. Utilities are cut. We stay inside, keep the windows boarded and the doors locked, watertight. The full Houdini. Yeah, what if I need some fresh air? We stay inside. Because? Because that's the plan. Found a bottle of black market tetracycline amidst the painkillers and aspirin and antihistamines. Start taking these, I said, whatever it says on the label. I'll be fine, Jimmy said. Hey, think about where you got those cuts and whether or not a little rubbing alcohol was enough to clean them. I don't like pills. You don't like pills. Can't swallow them, Jimmy said. Unnatural. I wasn't going to ask about his name. Yeah, we'll learn to make it natural, partner, because I will gut you in your sleep before I take you to a hospital. We played Texas Hold'em all afternoon and ate beef stew fired over a camping stove. We played cards into the night. Jimmy killed a case of PBR and I took his every last chip. But Skinner Jones never showed. Skinner's in the wind, Jimmy said. He moved slowly onto the cot, lifting his leg as though it were made of glass. And I'm out of here tomorrow. He put on a set of headphones and closed his eyes. See, Skinner Jones was holding my 20 grand that I owed Hoyle. Alive or dead, anyone found Skinner would tie him to the job and then to me. Smoke and mirrors would mount his head on their precinct wall and muscle every snitch in the city for the word on Johnny Farrow every day for the next 100 years. Unless Hoyle's numbers found me first. I'd never actually met Hoyle. Nobody met Hoyle. Hoyle was a disembodied name, 3 degrees removed from the game but still playing the board from a distance. You did business with a guy who worked for a guy who worked for some people, and eventually the chain of command stopped with Hoyle. But nobody ever made it that far. Anybody got too close or defaulted on a debt, Hoyle said to handle them by the numbers, as in normal procedure. This often required duct tape, maybe a trunk or perhaps a body of water. It always demanded discretion and, above all, silence. Hoyle's figure of speech became a running joke among the ranks, who each in turn met with Hoyle's disapproval for one reason or another. When the last man breathing had forgotten the joke became rumor, then legend. The numbers, Thing 1 and Thing 2, they could reckon the layout of a darkened room from the echo of a dripping tap. Thing 1 could freeze locks with his breath. Thing 2 could walk through glass, and they could measure your sleeping heartbeat with their ears against your door. A spider clung to the dry lip of the kitchen faucet, like a drop of black oil suspended from 8 bent black needles, its red belly mark like a symbol from a church window. Then a blink, it vanished up the pipe. I stuffed a wad of newspaper into the opening and tamped it tight with my thumb. And I didn't sleep that night. Every itch or stray thread brushing against me in the trapped air of the crumbling house became a drop of black widow oil, poised to plant her cocoon below my skin. Her dark little beads would hatch inside my blood while I waited for Skinner Jones, while I hid from smoke and mirrors, Hoyle, and the numbers. "We can't do shit here." Jimmy coughed, leaned over, and hawked into a garbage pail. 2 days of poker, canned food, police scanner, static network news, and no Skinner Jones. I was restless and Jimmy was sick. "Too bad. We're gonna stay. I need a hospital." "They're watching the hospitals," Jimmy argued until a coughing fit seized him and he covered his face with a t-shirt. "Christ," he said. "A few minutes of fresh air, for fuck's sake. There's a coffee place on 9th, across the muni stop. Let me run out, grab us a couple of lattes, maybe some deli sandwiches. On me." I knew the place. Soon as Jimmy mentioned it, I could almost hear the rumble of the train down Judah. Picture the burst of greenery in the park, the shape of crashing waves. "Hey," Jimmy said, "how long do you think we could last in here?" "A long time." "How long?" "Jimmy, we'd die of boredom before we ran out of food, and I'd probably kill you before that." "Come on, guess. I say 6 months." "Both of us?" "Yeah, if we had to." I surveyed the house, its fallout shelter food and black market drugs, the liquor supply, the plywood window sheets blocking out the sun and trapping in the bad air. "Yeah, 6 months sounds about right," I said. "It'd be like doing time, though." Jimmy shuffled the deck and flaunted his one-handed cut, the only card sleight he knew. "Well then, Jimmy, I guess you've never done time, have you?" His fingers slipped, and the cards hit the table. "Maybe I should deal." "Maybe we should up the stakes." He gave me his idea of a badass stare. "Up the stakes to what, Jimmy?" "Time." "Oh, I should have seen this coming." "We've got 180 days down here, each," Jimmy said. He reassembled the deck. "Let's do a 5-day ante, 2-day raise, and a 10-day limit." "Won't work, Jimmy."
"Why not?"
He shuffled. "Suppose I win your whole 6 months. That mean you get to walk out of here?" "Good point." He shuffled the deck a second time. How about we play for days outside? Each day we lose is a day we stay locked in here. But I want to stay locked in here, Jimmy. So, you can't lose. Fuck up though he was, I got why people hired him. I've seen you play, remember? Like I said. Jimmy shuffled the deck a third time and set it between us. You can't lose. Draw for the high card. Don't bother, I said. I cut the deck. Just deal. Now Jimmy had been working on his game. He used to be pure shark food. He'd play loose, never check, and he'd see every bet, big or small, to keep chasing some lone long shot card for that mythical winning hand. He was playing tighter now. He checked and folded more frequently, calculating my best possible hand instead of his own. He might take longer to get eaten, but he was still Jimmy Rehab, shark food. He went to sleep that night 3 weeks poorer, and by the next afternoon he was down a whole month and a half when the news ran a story about another Golden Gate suicide. Jimmy checked his cards and tossed a 5-day chip onto his 2-day ante. Wonder what makes this guy's high dive worth the airtime, he said. It was a good question. Unhappy civilians outnumbered the pigeons. Jumpers hit the bay like clockwork. I met his 5 and raised him 10. Jimmy folded and I scooped away another week of his life outside. The newscaster said the police wouldn't release the identity of the man found floating in the bay, but they believe he may have been linked to several high-profile robberies throughout the area. And right then, my vaporous suspicion condensed to a certainty. Skinner Jones, I said out loud. How do you know? It's one of those things. I stared at my chips, the stack of Jimmy's days together with mine. Well, at least we know what happened to the man. You want to stay here? Okay, not now, Jimmy. I had to think. Skinner Jones couldn't take the heat, he said. Sounds to me like we need to get out. Watch your mouth, Rehab. He hadn't heard me. He'd stuffed the balled-up shirt to his face to stifle another coughing jag, spat a heavy glob into the garbage pail, then, without warning, shoved his remaining chips into the pot. What the fuck, Jimmy? All or nothing, he said. Jimmy, your homeboy's a floater, he said, and if it wasn't an accident, then they know where to find us. Whoever took out Skinner Jones, except Skinner Jones, is on the way here. All or nothing, he said again. You lose, I walk. You win, we both stay down here. You win, we both stay locked in here until provisions run out. Now, I couldn't figure out what angle he was playing. Jimmy Rehab didn't know angles. Jimmy did the shit work for the guys who did. So my angle was to win the game and stick to the wager. Jimmy gets drunk, mopes for a day, crawls to the table to win it all back, and when I have a plan and I decide it's safe to leave, Jimmy's luck will suddenly improve. You got a bet, I said. I shuffled. Jimmy cut. I dealt 2 hands, then the flop. Ace of spades, ace of clubs, and the 8 of clubs. The game was sudden death hold'em, and we could discard and draw in lieu of each betting round. By the final draw, the 6 of clubs and the 8 of spades were face up with the others. I called. Jimmy showed. He held a pair of clubs. The king and the 2. Now the odds of drawing a flush in a typical game are 500-1. The odds against a king high flush are greater still, and if you're Jimmy Rehab, well, you start writing zeros till your arm drops off. His game had indeed improved. But he was still Jimmy Rehab, shark food. Get used to battlefield meals. I dropped my 8 of diamonds onto the flop for a full house.
Try sneaking out tonight, and I will gut you. Jimmy was pale. He stood, cracked open a beer, and limped towards his bunk. I'll win it all back tomorrow, he said. That calm of his again. First thing next morning, I made coffee. 30-weight black. Jimmy still hadn't moved. I could hear the deafening hiss from his headphones 8 feet away. 7 hours since he'd crashed, and his eardrums had to be in shreds. I pulled the headphones away, and like the spider darting up the dormant faucet, the smell hit my nose, rebounded off my brain, and crash-landed in my stomach. I'm supposed to say, Jimmy, hey man, wake up. But I don't bother. His lids were slack beneath my thumb, the thin skin pliant as an empty rubber glove, and his eyes had gone to frost. Once again, I hooked my knife at the cuff and sheared his pants ankle to thigh. The bandages were damp, with something thick and yellow. The veins in his leg had darkened with the trail of infection that had run rampant for the last few days. I dug the antibiotics from the pocket of his coat, the bottle unopened and every capsule accounted for. I dragged Jimmy Rehab to the bathroom, cradled his neck over the toilet and emptied out his blood with a knife stroke. Sounded like the time my father dumped his aquarium, but it lasted longer. I dropped his carcass into the bathtub and set to tearing Skinner's place apart for the next hour, searching for anything, tools, empty paint cans, anything. I drew a line above Jimmy's eyebrows and cut around his skull with a hacksaw, pulled at the top of his head until it broke suction with a loud, wheezing kiss. His brain held fast to his spine until I dug into both sides with a set of screwdrivers. Come on, Jimmy, give it up. You've never used this thing in your life. And it shot loose, bouncing off the shower tile and slipping down to the drain like a lump of gray soap. Happy Bastille Day, Jimmy. The guts and brains Jimmy never displayed in his life lay submerged in 7 different buckets of paint thinner, rubbing alcohol, or vodka. And I sealed them up with duct tape. So Skinner was dead. Ralph and George certainly weren't going to show up, so the 600 cans of gourmet meat were mine. The 250 pounds of cat litter were Jimmy's. I folded his arms, funeral style, rolled him into a sheet, and returned him to the bathtub, buried in tidy cat. A week passed. I monitored the police and fire frequencies, that godless ocean of misery and chaos beyond the glittery tide pool of the evening news. I heard dispatches to investigate suspicious odors, but never for this neighborhood. Somebody was always decomposing somewhere else. Thing was, I knew those other addresses, each one of them. I knew the dead guys, and they knew me. But they hadn't known where I'd end up. My word kept me alive, while the numbers kept looking. I ate canned salmon and drank warm beer. Outside, civilians drank at the Blackthorn, ate pizza by the slice, and rode the N. Judah through the fog. I breathed bad air and played solitaire and single-deck blackjack, betting painkillers, germ killers, matchsticks, money, or cigarettes. I wagered on the closing of the NASDAQ, the next day's weather and sports scores. I lost 25 tins of smoked oysters and 6 candy bars to the house when foreign object came in dead last, so I quit playing the ponies altogether. And the civilians on Irving fell in and out of love, in and out of bars, hailed cabs, and racked up parking tickets while I mastered the dartboard. I dug damp litter from the bathtub with a gardening trowel and dumped fresh litter in its place. After 4 50-pound bags, it stayed dry. Jimmy's face could have been cut from a rotting saddle. His lips were pulled back from his teeth for this hardened, loveless smile, and his eyes were windows to nothing but the hollow of his head. I don't have a single good reason for having exhumed him from his catbox coffin, though I have many bad ones, like a steady diet of boredom and paranoia spiked with bourbon and painkillers consumed in isolation. It's all impaired my judgment to such a degree that propping Jimmy in a chair seemed funny during the moment. I'd been wagering against an imaginary and anonymous house, and now that house had a name. I shuffled and cut. Watch and learn, Jimmy Rehab. Or at least watch, you can do that much. I burned the top card and dealt the next two and turned them over for the high card. I came up with the two of hearts while Jimmy showed a queen. Your deal, Jimmy. I want to believe I'm still here because of my word. The truth is, between the law and the numbers, I'd survive an hour above ground on a good day. I'm safe, and staying here is the only way I'll ever be certain that Skinner Jones didn't hand over a map to Plan Q before they snuffed him. Which means Skinner Jones never said Johnny Farrow, so he could walk away from the jewelry store. Jimmy's expression never changes. Pulls his hands in close with his fingers curled inward like clinging to some phantom noose. Fingernails keep growing, and I play his hands for him. I chase my bad run with a big bet, 10,000 milligrams to break even. Jimmy deals me a hard 20, two kings against his six up. My luck's turning, but Jimmy doesn't flinch. I split the kings for a hard 20 and a hard 17 before I stand. Jimmy draws a 5. Jimmy draws an ace. House rules call it a soft 16, so he hits. The king breaks his winning streak, and I drag 20,000 milligrams into my bottle. My luck is changing. But Jimmy Rehab doesn't say a word. Doesn't even blink. It's unnerving, I tell you. He stares right through me, like he's been doing for weeks.
In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums!
Thank you for listening to The Crime Wave. I'm your host, Seth Harwood. I hope you'll check out the rest of the stories here on Crime Wave and tell your friends about it. It's the CRIMEWAV. Help pass the word, register at our site so that you can participate in the forums and add comments to the episodes. You can email us with questions or comments at info@crimewave.com. Aldo, the mystery dog, and I will get your email and we'll get back to you right quick. You can also call the K7 line, 206-350-4998, to leave comments or feedback. And if you leave a great message, we'll even play it at the end of a show. So drop a line, hop on the website, visit often, spread the word, and thank you for stopping by The Crime Wave. Get trusted.